Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 547, interview number 10 with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy. This is being recorded on May 17th of the year 2015. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Peter Lavenda, the author of, among other titles, The Hitler Legacy, which will be the focal point of our program today and has been the focal point of our last nine, count them, nine programs. Peter, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you very much, as usual. Glad to be here.
Last weekend was the observation of the 70th anniversary of VE Day, what I would say was the ostensible defeat of the Third Reich in the Second World War. And as we sort of go into the gun lap and come down to the last couple of chapters of your magnificent book and contemplate the overall significance of the information you have presented, we're going to continue to follow the money, and perhaps we could consider, did Nazi Germany really lose the war, or did they go underground mafia style? And, well, we will contemplate the Hitler legacy. In the next to last chapter of your book, called Follow the Money, the victim from the Watergate scandal, you note that people like François Janoux and Hjalmar Schacht were trafficking in Nazi monies and actively implementing the Nazi economic diaspora, which we have spoken about, as well as the diaspora vis-a-vis personnel. And I wonder if you would develop the post-war financial slash terrorist activities of people like Janoux and Schacht.
Certainly, I'd be happy to. As you mentioned, the 70th anniversary of VE Day is also, in a sense, the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the Nazi diaspora and the Nazi underground. We can look at it from that point of view as well. The war ended. As far as the battle between nations was concerned, Germany obviously lost the war. But the Nazi Party did not lose the war. The Nazi Party continued to survive. They were a coterie of true believers, of people who had tremendous faith in what they were doing, who believed that what they were doing was right and necessary. So these are people who, even when they were being interviewed, as late as the 1980s or the 1990s, still professed their faith in what they had accomplished or tried to accomplish during the war, still expressed their satisfaction with the Holocaust, which is something which is very important because in the midst of all of the Holocaust deniers and the kind of revisionist history that's been there, the Nazis who did survive, who were officers in the SS, were proud of what they had tried to do during the Holocaust and were unrepentant and unapologetic about it. So you had a network of personnel that was very reliable, people that could be relied upon to carry out the program. Remember that a program had been set in place before the end of the war by Himmler in some cases and by people like Martin Bormann in other cases to survive the war. They saw the handwriting on the wall. At the latest in 1944 with the D-Day invasions. They knew that they were up against it, and instead of actually trying to marshal their resources to fight the war against the Allies, they instead decided that they were going to expatriate their funds, expatriate personnel and technology. So this was the beginning of this movement back in 70 years ago this month. This was the idea that, okay, the war is lost, Germany is lost, at least for the time being, but we have a program for bringing back Germany, for reuniting it, and for making Germany strong once again on one hand, and on the other, to keep the flame of Nazism alive. One of the people who was directly responsible for exporting Nazi ideology around the world was François Janoux. He was a Swiss financier. He was a Swiss citizen. He was an Abwehr agent, which means he was an agent of military intelligence during the war for the Nazis. He had belonged to something called the National Front, which was a pro-Nazi organization in Sweden. And as early as 1936, Jeannot actually traveled to Palestine to meet with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the Haj Amin al-Husseini. And they developed this lifelong friendship. And Jeannot moved to Berlin during the war and became very involved with al-Husseini in Berlin and developed schemes to promote the Palestine independence movement of al-Husseini and of his colleagues in the Middle East. So Jeannot was extremely involved with this sort of radical branch of Arab nationalism, which was avowedly pro-Nazi. And as the war was winding down, François Jeannot, who was in the banking industry, who was a financier, then was very involved with the money, with the bank accounts that were being held in Switzerland for the Nazis, the bank accounts they had set up during the war. Jeannot was in control of many of these accounts, as we find out later in the 1950s and the 1960s when Jeannot was very active. He has access to large amounts of funds with which he's able to finance Arab nationalist movements and Palestine liberation movements for decades. Jeannot was a very, very prominent player where this is concerned. Going back to his relationship with al-Husseini, he financed the Algerian Liberation Front, for instance, in the 1950s. He was supplying weapons to the Algerian Liberation Front, meeting members of the front in Egypt in the 1950s. He created a import-export company in North Africa to facilitate the movement of guns and money to the Arab nationalists there. He was even involved in propaganda efforts, along with people like Johann von Leers, who was the propagandist under Goebbels, who wound up himself in Egypt running anti-Israel propaganda there. Jeannot was familiar with all of these people. He was an intimate of these individuals. He was a fellow traveler completely, but more importantly to the cause of the Nazi underground, he had access to the bank accounts in Switzerland. He wasn't the only one, of course. Hjalmar Schacht had his own sources of income. Skorzeny, of course, worked very closely with Jeannot and with Hjalmar Schacht. I mean, Skorzeny and Hjalmar Schacht went back a very long time. They were virtually relatives to a certain extent. So we have a very tight-knit little community. And they were not just interested in feathering their own nests. They were not interested in just having a lavish lifestyle with their ill-gotten gains. This money was being used for a purpose. This money had was earmarked for a political and even a military agenda. So Jeannot was one of these people that was phenomenal as far as the Nazi underground was concerned because of his access to the money and his willingness to put it to good use. He was one of the people who was involved in arranging the defense of Adolf Eichmann in Israel when he was captured in Argentina and brought to Israel to stand trial in order to help with his defense. It was Jeannot who came to the rescue. Jeannot was very intimately involved with virtually every extreme right-wing movement in that period of time. We're talking the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, until his death in 1996, when he was being seriously questioned at that time about his involvement with all of these groups. He died just before he could be subpoenaed and brought to be interrogated by authorities as to the extent of his involvement with neo-Nazi organizations as well as the Nazi underground itself and, of course, the radical Islamist movements in North Africa. So we have a really fascinating individual in François Jeannot. He was able to bring together the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, with the Nazi personnel that he knew intimately from the war. He was able to have to create a kind of marriage of convenience or of like-minded ideologies between the Nazis in his underground circles and the PLO. He helped provide training. He helped provide arms. And he was doing, again, all of this with money that had been seized by the Nazis over the course of the war years and the confiscation of Jewish property and the property of other people throughout Eastern Europe and the Balkans and everywhere else. And this was Jeannot's, this was his claim to fame, and he was, how shall I put it, he was a very reliable source for this through his entire life. he was one of those true believers. Now, we have seen in the press in the last couple of years, every once in a while they find a concentration camp guard, an SS man somewhere, which they bring to trial, and they're in their 80s or their 90s, and they're talking about you know, what they did during the war. And we tend to lose sight of the fact that it was the people who were very visible, like François Jeannot, like Hjalmar Schacht, who were the most instrumental in keeping that horror alive, just in different manifestations. So we have a financier like Jeannot or like Schacht, or like some of the gun-running operations developed by Skorzeny and Hans-Ulrich Rudel. These guys were all over the place, very visible, and continuing to support and extend the reach of the Nazi underground, the very people who were responsible for some of the worst crimes of the Third Reich, and they continue to operate in the world at large with impunity. So it's a case, sometimes to me, of misdirection. I'm not against going after the concentration camp guards and the people who might have been responsible for the deaths of innocent civilians in the death camps, but by the same token, we should not lose sight of the fact that the people who finance this, that organize this, and then continue to support this ideology were at times quite visible and quite well known, and were never really taken to task for their contributions to the perpetuation of the Nazi ideology around the world.
Peter, as we follow the money and as we prepare to discuss the Skorzeny syndrome, an area that will, a geographical area that will, I think, defy people's ideological stereotypes rather thoroughly, is the tri-border area of Latin America. Tell us about that, if you would, please.
Yeah, this is an area that there's not a lot of attention given to it these days, but it's extremely important and still a very dangerous part of the world. The tri-border area is in South America. It's between Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay. Paraguay, basically, its only reason for existence is smuggling. They used to say that smuggling contributed to roughly 80% of Paraguay's GDP. It's a very dangerous area. It's a very sort of a savage landscape that we're talking about. And you have people who are crossing the border constantly. They have been for generations. It was an area that is prone to smuggling. It makes its living off of smuggling. And we're talking smuggling could be anything from electronics and appliances to guns and drugs and people. The tri-border area is a place where they have discovered that not only are local Paraguayans or Argentines or Brazilians involved, but people from virtually all over the world are smuggling and engaged in nefarious activities at that region. A very small region, but it's a place where the Nazi underground, of course, has worked. We have, if you look at the Hans-Ulrich Rudel address book in the back of the Hitler Legacy, you'll find enormous, you know, there's many lists of people who are operating in Paraguay at all levels of the government. Hans-Ulrich Rudel had passed through there, of course, as had Mengele, as had Skorzeny, and many of the others. This was a very conducive part of the world. You could go there and hide forever. The authorities could not reach you. They could not touch you. And you can become involved in everything from, as I said, gun and drug smuggling to human trafficking. And as we found out in the last 20, 30 years or so, it's also been an area where you can move personnel involved in terrorist activities, not just for the extreme right, not just the kind of Nazi-inspired Operation Condor type operations in that part of the world, but also Al-Qaeda linked organizations also use that part of the world to move money and personnel back and forth across borders. We are not so aware of the fact that there are large movements of personnel who are allied with groups like Al-Qaeda in Latin America, from Mexico all the way down into the tri-border region. There was a lot of Arab and Middle Eastern immigration to South America for the last 100 years or so. There are some famous personalities who have Arab backgrounds, for instance. The famous actress Salma Hayek is, I believe, is of Lebanese extraction, although she's a Mexican, for instance, as an example. So you have a lot of people with that background in those parts of the world. Some are still Muslim. There's a large Muslim community in central Mexico, for instance, which is not to say they're terrorists, but it does give a kind of an environment where people from the Middle East could pass easily without necessarily being noticed. And you have that those networks existing in South America pretty much with impunity. The governments there have their hands full with other issues, so they're not really paying much attention to what's going on down there. And the tri-border region is one where you have a lot of, very strange very strange stuff taking place. So we have to pay attention to these things. We tend to be distracted by other geographical areas, but South America is very important in this age when we're talking about the possibility of global terrorism or the or groups that are using terrorism to facilitate their political agenda. Latin America is a country that is a country is a region that we have to focus on, because this is as the Middle East boils over and we start getting the growth of new terrorist type organizations in Africa, you're also going to see a corresponding rise in certain parts of Latin America as well. So these are things we really need to pay attention to.
You also write about the terrorists abusing the ancient Hawala system of Islamic finance. I wonder if you would tell us about that, describing the Hawala system in and of itself. And we should emphasize very strongly that the Hawala system is not a terrorist network in any size, shape, or fashion, but it has been abused. Develop that for us, if you would, please.
Sure. The Hawala system is very old. It goes back hundreds, if not more than 1,000 years. It's a system of money transfer, which does not use paperwork, which is does not go through the normal banking system. It's an honor system, basically. And what it is if a person in well, I'm familiar with, for instance, in Queens, New York, where there were hawaladars working, people who were hawala brokers. Someone could go to a broker, could be at a jewelry store or a money-changing operation in New York City, let's say, and they want to send $1,000 to a relative in Peshawar, in Pakistan, as an example. They go in, they give the money to the local broker, they get a code name or a code word. Then the person who wants to send the money then tells the code word to their relative in Peshawar, and that person then goes to a hawaladar, a hawala broker, in that city with that code word, and they pick up the money, usually minus a certain handling fee between the two brokers. There's no paper trail on this. There's no there's nothing that's observable to the international banking system. It's invisible for the most part. And you may ask yourself, well, how does one broker pay the other? And again, it's an honor system. This is usually done through relatives or through family friends or something like that. The compensation may be in cash, but it may also be in gold. It may be in electronics. It may be in appliances. It may be even be in drugs at times. And it may even be in terms of personnel. It could be that you have relatives in that part of the world who can work for the hawala broker to pay off the debt by doing errands, running errands across country perhaps or internationally. There's all sorts of ways to work off the debt. The brokers themselves know how much they owe and how much is owed to them. But those are the only people who know. No one else knows. Governments don't know. NGOs don't know. Security systems don't know. Security agencies have no idea what really is going on. Now, the Hawala system has been abused in the past. There have been arrests in some cases. It's an ancient, venerable system. As I say, it's an honor system. It is open to abuse, obviously. And it's been known that terrorist organizations have made use of the Hawala system to finance things. Most of the terrorist groups prior to or up to and including the 9/11 attacks were using the actual banking systems and using regular wire transfers. Now, since the clampdown on this, since the United States in particular is demanding a lot of reporting from all the international banks, making it almost impossible for an American to open up a bank account overseas in some places, because of this situation, there's been more and more recourse to other forms of transferring money around, and the Hawala system is very conducive to this, and it can be used to finance terrorist operations or any kind of military or political operations in different countries, again, without a paperwork trail. So it's invisible to governments, it's invisible to security services. It seems tailor-made for this process. But as you said at the very beginning, most people who use this system are doing it quite innocently. They're doing it because they're sending money back home, or they're paying for things abroad, or whatever it happens to be. Just because you're using a Hawala system doesn't mean you're a terrorist, obviously. And just because you're a Hawala broker doesn't mean you have ties to any kind of terrorist activity. But just as the banks may not consciously know that some of their accounts are being used to finance drug operations, for instance, the Hawala brokers also don't necessarily know where that money is going, where it's being used for.
Peter, the last chapter of your book is called the Skorzeny Syndrome, named, of course, basically after Otto Skorzeny, the SS colonel and Nazi commando chief and primary Odessa functionary. How would you describe briefly, and then we'll develop this at greater length, the Skorzeny legacy? What is it? What produced it? And how does that fit in, or the Skorzeny syndrome, excuse me, how is that a manifestation of the Hitler legacy?
Well, very, very clearly, I got the concept of the Skorzeny syndrome from a man called Glenn Infield. Glenn Infield was a historian of World War II, particularly of the SS. He knew Skorzeny personally. He met Skorzeny and interviewed him a number of times, and he wrote a biography of Skorzeny called Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando. It's a very valuable book, and for some reason it's not the kind of book that you'll find on a lot of bookshelves of those who are studying the war, and yet it's invaluable because of the interviews with Skorzeny. And he says it very well, and I'll just quote what he says. He says, terrorism, the Skorzeny syndrome, is flourishing in the modern world, a reminder that Hitler and Nazism are still taking their toll more than three decades after the Third Reich collapsed. He published that in 1981. This is long before the events of 9/11, long before the rise of Al-Qaeda. The Taliban was just getting underway. All of these things were brand new at the time or hadn't happened yet. And yet Infield very prophetically talks about this. He knew, because of his conversations with Skorzeny, that Skorzeny was heavily involved in fomenting terror operations around the world. Skorzeny and his people and his colleagues were very much involved with, as we mentioned, with François Junot and Hjalmar Schacht and all of these other personalities who were intent on developing an extreme right-wing political agenda throughout the world. I mean, through not only in Europe, but in North Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, everywhere. These were people who were intent on doing this. They didn't have an army anymore. The Germans, the Nazis did not have an army any longer. So they had puppet armies. They had puppet armies, as in, for instance, the PLO, or in al-Fatah, or the PFLP in Palestine, the Algerian Liberation Front, and all of these organizations which served as kind of puppets of the underground Nazi regime. And I would include Operation Condor in Latin America along with that, Colonia Dignidad, of course, the Odessa organization of people who were fleeing justice, people like Mengele, Klaus Barbie, and the others. All of these individuals were not simply hiding in the woods someplace hoping that people would forget about them. They were actively involved in promoting the Nazi agenda. And they did this through terror. These were asymmetrical warriors. We talk about terrorism as asymmetrical warfare, and that normally means you have a guerrilla organization of some kind, a disparate group fighting a well-organized army. So it's not symmetrical, it's asymmetrical. The Nazis developed this. I mean, the whole idea of the werewolf operation at the end of World War II was devoted to the concept of asymmetrical warfare, the kind of harassing warfare, assassination, sabotage, that sort of thing. The Nazis carried this to a fine art. Skorzeny was a commando. Skorzeny's background was in guerrilla warfare. This is what he excelled at. This is what he trained people at around the world. Skorzeny and his colleagues, people like Klaus Barbie and the Fiancés of Death in Bolivia and in South America in general. These are people who were using unconventional means of warfare to promote their ideology, long before there was an Al-Qaeda, long before we even talked very much about Arab terrorism, except from the concept of the PLO or Black September or Al-Fatah. But these were groups, Al-Fatah, Abu Nidal, the PLO, that were being actively trained and supported by Skorzeny. So terrorism itself and the use of terrorism to promote a political agenda in the 20th century and now the 21st was something that the Nazi underground had developed into an art, had developed as a tool of their policy. They knew they could not field battalions, tanks and aircraft carriers and all the rest of the stuff to prosecute a war against their enemies. So they did it the only way they knew they could, which was through the use of terrorism. We had people like Stefano Della Chiaia, who was an Italian fascist who was carrying out assassinations and sabotage in Latin America and in Europe, a friend again of Skorzeny and the people around Skorzeny. We have these ideas of the bombings in Spain, the bombings in Germany, all carried out by extreme right-wing fanatics because they wanted to kill Americans. They attacked military bases in Germany. They blew up train stations. They killed civilians. All of this was to promote an extreme right-wing agenda, and it started that way. And now we're dealing with terrorism, which groups like Al-Qaeda have learned at the feet of the Nazi trainers in Egypt and in North Africa and in Latin America and in Asia, people who have had the background. They were battle-tested. They had been blooded during the war. They were fearless Nazis, ideologues of the Nazi regime, ideologues of Nazism in general, who brought with them not only their training in commando operations, not only their training in terrorism and in building IEDs and that sort of thing, they also brought with them their ideology. They brought with them their point of view. They brought with them their approach to the geopolitical scene. How do you cause change? How do you do it on a budget? You know, how do you destabilize a regime on a budget? How do we accomplish these sorts of things? And this is what the Nazis were about, and this is what the Skorzeny syndrome is about. What we're experiencing today are the ripple effects of that movement, beginning in 1945 and extending to this day for the last 70 years. This is the Skorzeny syndrome. We just don't see it yet because we tend to compartmentalize. We tend to put things in boxes, and we don't really see the connections between all of this. But without Skorzeny, without François Junot, without Hjalmar Schacht, where would the liberation organizations in the Middle East and North Africa be today? You have to ask yourself that, because they provided money. They provided training. They assisted in propaganda. They assisted in terrorist activities, in running guns. All of this was from the Nazi underground. All of this was through people like Junot and Schacht and Skorzeny and Rudel and all the others. They gave the impetus, they gave the courage, in a sense, to tell these people that what you're doing is right. We may have lost the war, in a sense, but we've just simply moved the theater of operations. The Nazis moved out of Germany when they had to, and they scattered around the world and moved their theater of operations to North Africa and the Middle East and the rest of the world. It was a movement of people and personnel and technology, and we're still suffering with that to this day because we don't recognize it. We don't see it. We refused to go after the Nazi underground after the war because we were so afraid of communism. And because of that, we allowed this kind of a fungus, you might say, to grow in the darkness and in the moisture of the basement of our consciousness. These things have grown and multiplied. And it doesn't look like Nazism anymore, but there are so many connections back to Skorzeny. There are so many connections back to Odessa that it's impossible to untangle them.
One of the very first elements of discussion in the Hitler legacy is a person that we have on this program we've spoken about before, and that is the late Jörg Haider, the so-called yuppie fascist, a really prominent right-wing, well, he was a fascist, but a very prominent Austrian politician. And you talk about him moving monies on behalf of Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, of the late Saddam Hussein of Iraq. And then you also in connection with, because you're sort of projecting some thoughts into the head of the late Haider. He was killed in an auto accident. And you also talk about Ahmed Huber and the bank Al-Taqwa. I wonder if you would develop that for us. First, Haider, Saddam Hussein, and Qaddafi money, and then Ahmed Huber, or Albert Huber as he was known at birth, and the bank Al-Taqwa, something well known to listeners to this program because they held an account for Al-Qaeda.
Certainly. I find the character of Yorick Haider, particularly compelling. Here was someone who was a political leader in Austria who ran on a very sort of neo-fascist, neo-Nazi platform. Jörg was the governor of Carinthia in Austria. He ran on an anti-Slovene platform. He felt that there were so many people living in Austria who were of Eastern European extraction, the Slovenes. They had road signs in both German and Slovenian. They had newspapers and they had stores, in both languages. And who Jörg Haider ran on a platform of eradicating Slovenian from all of these signs. He wanted Austria for the Austrians. He was a typical sort of very right wing, as I say. He was called a yuppie fascist. He was very involved with the far right in Austria, the parties that were constantly being shut down or suppressed one way or the other, their leaders arrested if they were engaged in pro-Nazi activities. People like Remmer, who was the general from the Operation Valkyrie era, who was very involved in Austrian right-wing politics. Haider had these connections. He had these beliefs. And he was a very well-spoken, very charismatic type, very young, very, as we say, a yuppie fascist. He died during a car accident, a car crash in 2008. What was interesting was that, upon his death, it was revealed that he had numerous bank accounts in places like Luxembourg and Liechtenstein, known for their banking secrecy, laws in those days. And these bank accounts contained funds from Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. We're talking about a lot of money, and we don't know what that money was for. To this day, we don't know why he would be the recipient of this largesse from these individuals. We don't know what that was all about. But as an extreme right-wing leader in Austria, which was, let's face it, the birthplace of Adolf Hitler and so many of the other prominent Nazis, and as someone who ran on these platforms and had deep sympathies with the far right, whose parents had been Nazis, very vocal Nazis during the war. Now we get to a situation where he's accepting, they may have been campaign contributions or something, but they were hidden. These were blind trusts. This was money, to which we don't know what strings were attached. And he had this money from some of the worst, Middle Eastern dictators the world has known in recent memory, Gaddafi and, Saddam Hussein. So this naturally led to other areas of interest. Who was a friend of, for instance, of Jörg Haider? We have the person that you mentioned, Ahmed Huber, another Swiss Nazi. For some reason, Switzerland has it more than its fair share, I think, of contemporary Nazis. And Ahmed Huber was one of them. Huber was a contact of Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, as well as the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. It's possible that Huber was kind of a go-between between Haider and Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. We just don't know. We don't know all the details. But Ahmed Huber was the founder, one of the founders, of a bank called Al-Taqwa. Al-Taqwa was a bank that was running funds and laundering money for a lot of pro-Arab nationalist groups and what we would call today terrorist groups. Saeed Ramadan, who was a very prominent member of the Muslim Brotherhood in Europe, for instance, was also involved with the Al-Taqwa Bank in Switzerland. Ahmed Huber was a Swiss who had converted to Islam. He was a Nazi. I mean, he was a Nazi, you might say neo-Nazi, because he did not serve in the war. He was not part of the World War II situation, but he was, a devoted Nazi. He had photographs of Hitler and of the Ayatollah Khomeini in his apartment, for instance. He was known to be very friendly with all of the Nazi underground on the one side and the Islamic groups, the fundamentalist extreme right, you might say, Islamic groups on the other. He was the go-between. So there is the connection between Hoover and Gaddafi, Hussein, and Yorick Haider. So we don't know all the details. I think when this started, when the scandal started to break, there was a lot of covering up that was taking place in Europe as to the full extent of this relationship that Haider might have had with Arab despots. We just don't know the full story. We may never know. But it may have something to do with the Swiss bank accounts through Hoover, the Al-Taqwa Bank, which was implicated in the in involvement with Al-Qaeda, for instance, and other terrorist groups. These implications were always there. So this is one of those areas which we can still do some research on today because it's very suggestive of a darker and a deeper nexus between the extreme right in Europe and Islamic terrorist organizations. So this is something that we really need to look at, and governments seem to be reluctant to do so, possibly because actually uncovering some of this information would lead to some uncomfortable truths. As I mentioned at some point in our conversations, when the Clinton administration decided they wanted to find out what had happened to all the Nazi gold and what had happened to Nazi financing after the war, they were only able to scratch the surface of it. They only got very little detail. And even that detail was extremely damning and extremely unnerving when you realize the extent of what was going on. And even then, the committee said we just didn't have time or the resources to really pursue this story. And I think that story would have eventually led to Hoover and to Haider and to the Al-Taqwa Bank and, of course, the Bank of International Settlements and et cetera, et cetera, and finally to Jeannot and Schacht and down to terrorist organizations of today. So that's the Skorzeny syndrome, and that's how the Skorzeny operations have been financed and continue to be financed to this day.
On page 307, Peter, you have a couple of paragraphs that I think might be said to be a thesis statement for your book. Yes. Would you like to read those for us?
Certainly. Yes, it's on page 307 of the book, in, I think, the chapter called the Skorzeny syndrome.
Precisely, yes.
Mm-hmm. After World War II, the American people thought that Nazi Germany had been defeated and the war was over. This book demonstrates that it never was. Instead, we were told that communism was the new threat and we had to pull out all the stops to prevent a communist takeover of the country. And so our military and our intelligence agencies collaborated with surviving Nazis to go after communists. We refused to pursue worldwide right-wing terror groups and assassins. After all, they were killing communists and leftists. They were doing us a service. Like Hoover and the Mafia, the CIA refused to believe a Nazi underground existed, even as they collaborated with it via the Galen Organization and the like. The whole thrust of this book has been that American leaders in business, finance, media, and politics collaborated with Nazis before, during, and after the war. The West's share in the blame for Al-Qaeda et al. Goes back a long way, before Eisenhower, to a cabal of extremist U.S. Army generals and emigre Eastern Europeans who didn't have much of a problem with Nazism since they feared communism more. The Church, the Tibetans, the Japanese, the Germans, the Croatians, and the Americans all felt that communism was the greater danger long before World War II. We enlisted war criminals to fight on our side. We appropriated the idea of global jihad from the Nazis and their World War I predecessors. We amped up their plan to weaponize religion and convinced Muslims, who hated each other, to band together to fight communism. And when Afghanistan was liberated and the Soviet Union was defeated, September 11th, 2001,
Indeed, and there was the aforementioned bank, Al-Taqwa, actually had an account with an unlimited line of credit for Al-Qaeda. And you mentioned Albert or Ahmed Hoover. He was actually a protege of the aforementioned, somebody you have mentioned, Johann von Leers, the Grand Mufti. And yes, at the time when the bank Al-Taqwa was coalescing, he was meeting on an almost daily basis with Francois Jeannot. So when people think about September 11th, they want to be thinking about far more than just Al-Qaeda per se or bin Laden per se, because that is an event that has a profound legacy, and many of the evidentiary tributaries go in the direction of what I call the Underground Reich and the Skorzeny syndrome. Peter, in your book you have some appendices, and one of them is the telephone book of Hans Ulrich Rudel. Refresh us about who he was and why you included that, what significance you see in putting his telephone book at the end of your book.
Certainly. Hans Ulrich Rudel was a Luftwaffe pilot. He was an ace pilot. He was very famous during World War II. He was a charismatic individual. He flew something like more than 80 missions or shot down more than 80 other aircraft. He was a remarkable individual, someone who was born to fly. And after the war, he was subjected to the usual denazification treatment by the Allies. And according to one source that I spoke with who knew Rudel personally, he mentioned that Rudel actually became more of a Nazi after the war than he was during the war. During the war, he was a pilot. He fought for his country. He was patriotic. But after the war, he found that the demonization of Germany was such that he felt he started to have sympathies for the Nazi cause and the Nazi ideology. Whether you believe that or not, I'm not sure that I do, but that's what was told to me by sources. It's possible, but in the end, what this resulted in was Hans Ulrich Rudel becoming basically an organizer of Odessa, of the underground Nazi organization, or the underground Reich, as you put it. He was involved with Skorzeny very deeply. They traveled together in some cases. They met high-ranking Nazis in exile all over the world, helped to finance them. Where Skorzeny was running guns and money, Rudel was kind of the poster boy for the Third Reich, or let's call it the Fourth Reich. He was a very charismatic individual. But at the same time, he was very much involved with the Nazi underground. And the reason I included the phone book in the first place, it was, I think, accidentally declassified. It was part of the file on Josef Mengele. It was included in the Mengele file, which had been declassified by CIA. So I managed to get, of course, a copy of that file. And as I was going through it, I found this phone book. I mean, photocopies of pages and pages and pages of names and addresses and phone numbers all over the world. And as I began to realize it, there was a notation on one page that said this belonged to Hans Ulrich Rudel. Well, basically what you have in this phone book is a guide to the Nazi underground. I mean, the names and addresses of people are from all over the world, from Europe, from North America, South America. There are a few in Asia and Africa. You know, this is like the equivalent of today's Facebook page with all your friends on it, you know. Before there was social media, people had, you know, little black books, and they had phone books, and they kept all this information there. These were his friends. These were people that he knew, that he worked with. In some cases, he had multiple phone numbers for them, different contact information. And as I went through the phone book, it was handwritten, of course, in a German hand and all of that, so it took me some time to go through, to do the translation, to identify the individuals. I've identified, I would say, over 95% of the people in that phone book, identified where they were located. Some of them, I discovered, are still living all around the world. They're still alive today. They were friends of Rudel during that time, including Americans all over the country, including people in Canada. David Irving is in there, the famous Holocaust denier. Klaus Barbie is in there under his pseudonym Klaus Altmann and his address in Bolivia. This is, of course, obviously before he was arrested and extradited back to France to stand trial for war crimes. We have, I can't even begin to tell you, there's just hundreds of names, many of them, as I mentioned, in Paraguay, including leaders of industry in Paraguay, people who were prominent in the Paraguayan airline, for instance, the CEO of that airline, who was also a famous pilot. There's all sorts of individuals in that book that were friends and confidants of Rudel. And this leads us to understand the reach that this organization had, the reach that Rudel, in his personal phone book, not, you know, a sort of general massive file on all the people that he knew. But these are the people that were closest to him, people that he wanted to constantly be in contact with, including at one point Mengele's lawyer, the guy who was acting as the go-between, the courier between the Mengele family in Europe and Mengele in South America. There's the address for Miguel Serrano, who was this famous Nazi apologist in Chile, a member of the Nazi Party since the 1930s, who was also a friend of the Dalai Lama. So there's a number of fascinating individuals in this address book, and I could not pass up the chance to include this because this is the first time it's been seen, identified, the names identified, the phone numbers and addresses listed, and it's all there. And I'm hoping that perhaps future researchers into the subject will be able to make some use of it, too, to find out the people that knew Riddle, that he knew, what were the connections, what were the relationships. As I say, there's addresses, phone numbers, you know, all over the world, including in Canada. The name of Ernst Zundel, who was a famous fascist, famous pro-Nazi, living in Canada, who was arrested a number of times in Canada because of his Holocaust-denying stance on things. He published he had a publishing house called Samizdat that published all sorts of weird Nazi UFO stuff and everything. He was part of Riddle's network as well, his circle of friends. So there's a lot of very interesting people in that address book, and my hope is that it helps to prove what it is that I'm asserting in the book, that we're talking about something, we're talking about a movement that had connections in very high places in government, including in our own. One of the sources I spoke with was an engineer, an aeronautical engineer, who knew Riddle personally. He spoke German. He was able to interview Riddle on behalf of the Pentagon, on behalf of the Defense Department, because the Defense Department was interested in developing new aircraft, new types of aircraft, and who better to talk to about piloting aircraft than Hans Ulrich Riddle. So Riddle actually was a source for us in the 1950s, 1960s, for helping us to understand how better to design aircraft that would be more responsive to pilot controls. So all of this stuff is extremely important for us to understand that we're not making this stuff up. This is not something that is the result of some wild speculation. But here it is in Hans Ulrich Riddle's own hand, his own phone book, the list of the people that he consorted with, the people that he worked with. And as I say, some of them alive to this day. I've spoken to some of them, so they're still around. And this is the reach that one member, one leader only, of the Nazi underground had. Not even talking about Skorzeny, not even talking about some of the others. So it's a fascinating story, and I think that the names and addresses are really worth further research, more than I've done in my footnotes in that section.
William Faulkner, the author, noted that the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And I think the Riddle notebook, or the Riddle phone book, I guess you could say all of them had party lines, and those party lines were Nazi party lines.
Sure.
Is exemplary of that. One of the last things I ever heard of Riddle was he was training Argentine pilots during the Falklands War to sink British warships. So, again, they continued their struggle long after the official conclusion of it. At VE Day. We have just over 10 minutes left, Peter. You also have an appendix in your book. You interview, I believe, one of the Bali bombers. Tell us about that.
Yes.
And how you feel that manifests the Hitler legacy.
Certainly. Back in the year 2007, I was in Indonesia. I was taking classes at Gajah Mada University, which is their Harvard. And I was taking various classes there. I was working towards my master's degree in religious studies. And at that point, there was a meeting of an organization called Psychologists for Peace. And I got sort of seconded into this thing and was going to do a presentation for them and everything else, which I did on globalization at the time. And part of the agenda is we would go to the city of Solo in Indonesia, on the island of Java, not far from Yogyakarta, where I was living. And we would go to Solo, and we would go to the Pesantren, the religious boarding school, that was the base for a man called Abu Bakr Ba'asyir. or ABB, as we refer to him by his initials. Abu Bakr Ba'asyir, of course, was one of the founders, one of the two founders of Jama'a Islamiyah, which was an al-Qaeda affiliate. He was responsible for the Bali bombings in Bali in 2002, on October 12, 2002. Responsible by that, I mean he didn't lay the bombs himself or plant the bombs, but he did. He was responsible for the personnel who carried out that attack and was responsible for instigating it, for inspiring it, and controlling it from his base in Solo. He was eventually arrested for that attack. He was in prison for a short time, but somehow managed to avoid further prosecution. He was out and at liberty in 2007. We went there, this entire group of Americans, Australians, people from different countries. We actually went to his pesantren and sat right in front of him and listened to him talk about his philosophy, which freaked out some of the Australians in the crowd. Most the people who died in the Bali bombings of 2002 were Australian. They were tourists in Bali at the time, so some Australians refused to actually even go there. And I can understand that, certainly, but I wanted to see this from my own eyes because this is what I do, this is what I research, and was able to hear from ABB himself his philosophy, which is warmed over protocols of the learned elders of Zion. It's the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. Everything that we've talked about for the last more or less 10 sessions, these are all things that Abu Bakr Ba'asyir believed and was the motivation for his jihad, let's say, against the West. He basically said that the attacks in Bali were a mistake because the local people were killed, local businesses were attacked, that in the future, you know, attacks would be carried out against the crusaders themselves in their own countries. I mean, he basically laid out his platform, but doing it in such a way that he couldn't be held accountable for actually instigating it or inspiring people to commit these atrocities, but just basically saying that in the future we'll just manage it better and not do it locally, which was his attempt, I think, to stay clear of the Indonesian authorities. He's back in prison now, by the way. He was found responsible for getting involved in different kinds of assassination attempts in Indonesia and sabotage attempts. He's a firebrand. He's been very vocal. Some of his forewords that he's written to other books, he's written them in for very similar to conspiracy literature, the kind of conspiracy literature that's sort of tabloid style. I have some of his writings. There have been books published in Indonesia in that language, which looked like something out of David Icke. I mean, it's all Illuminati symbols and, you know, the dollar bill and, you know, who really are the Bushes? Are they really, you know, the descendants of the Pharaoh and all kinds of wild stuff that goes on in there. And ABB, Abu Bakr Ba'asyir, puts his, you know, his imprimatur on this material. So it's a conspiracy theory fueled political ideology. It's very difficult to say that this is an Islamic ideology. When you listen to him speak, there's less of Islam in it than there is of the protocols of Zion and the Jewish, worldwide Jewish conspiracy and against capitalism and against the West in general. This is more of a culture war than it is a religious war, at least from the point of view of one leader that I was able to talk to and see in Indonesia just less than 10 years ago. So that's why my focus and my point of view on the whole Islamic quote-unquote terrorist thing is a little bit different than you might hear it in the regular media, because I've lived in Muslim countries. I lived in Malaysia for 7 years. I lived in Indonesia. I spent a lot of time in that part of the world among Muslims in general, as well as, you know, beginning my research with the PLO in 1968-67, visiting their offices in New York City. So I've been around this for a while, and my perception, my perspective on this is quite different from the sort of standard word bubble stuff you get on CNN or Fox News or any place like that. It's a little bit more nuanced, and I'm looking at a conflict that is less about religion per se than it is about power, than it is about paranoia, than it is about conspiracy theory. So it's a different, I have a different perspective on it, and I try to make that plain in Hitler Legacy as much as I could.
Peter, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left in the interview. I'm going to perhaps request the impossible. Given that it probably is impossible, but in that time, how would you encapsulate the Hitler legacy, and in the same breath, why should people and how can they order the book?
Well, I'll take the possible first. They can order the book through Amazon.com, of course. They can get it Barnes & Noble. I have a website called peterlavenda.com. You might be able to contact me there if you have any problems sourcing the material or if you have any questions. As far as the Hitler legacy is concerned and what that's all about, how to encapsulate it, I feel that we are in a very dangerous stage in history. I think that we are allowing basically a handful of psychopaths on the other side of the world determine our political future, determine the future of the world, because we are basically falling prey to a propaganda system that has very little to do with religion as we understand it, very little to do with anything other than power and the operations designed to increase the power of a handful of groups. The Hitler legacy, I think, was designed to help people understand that there's more to this story and to think twice before jumping on board with this sort of anti-Islamic quote-unquote crusade that we seem to be on, or as some people seem to be on. I want people to understand that jihad, this idea of a global jihad, was not invented by Muslims. It was invented by Germans. It was invented by a German archaeologist in World War I. I want people to understand that we've used the weaponization of religion in order to promote political agendas, and now that it's coming to bite us in the foot. I was going to use another term. So it's coming back to get us. We are suffering because of our myopia on this issue. We want simple answers. We want simple problems that have simple answers. And this is not simple. We need better education. We need to educate ourselves before we elect political leaders that are going to make the same mistakes that we've been making, or before we allow cultural representatives to portray the system in the world today in terms that are so far removed from reality, it's not funny. I know we're running out of time. I just have one more thing, probably. I've been very much watching the interplay between Muslim apologists on the one hand and people attacking Islam on the other, on the regular media, on various programs. And there is such a lack of real information concerning this. There's such a lack of real information concerning, of course, the Nazi underground and its relationship to it, that I feel like I'm a person watching two cars about to crash, and I keep putting my foot on the brake, but there is no brake because I'm an observer, and I'm watching it, and I'm trying desperately to get these cars from crashing. It's just a reflex motion, but that's what I feel. So this is what I've been doing. This is my position on this. I'm trying to get people to stop making some terrible, terrible choices that we may be facing in the very near future.
Author Edith Wharton once observed that, quote, a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. And I think the Hitler legacy and what we are witnessing around the world as manifestations of that could be embodied in or encapsulated in Ms. Wharton's observation. We have been speaking with Peter Lavenda, not only in this hour, but the previous 9 hours. And the most common thing that I get, the most common comment that I receive from listeners, is they say, well, I believe what you're saying, but I don't know what to do about it. I feel helpless. One of the things they can do about it is to go out, get the book, The Hitler Legacy, read it, and tell people about it. And as I've said before, it's not a very long book. My reaction upon reading it was, Dr. Livingston, I presume. Only in this case, Peter Lavenda. This concludes For the Record program number 547, interview number 10 with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy. This is being recorded on May 17th of the year 2015. For Peter Lavenda, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.